Good afternoon, Brian. How are you?
Hi, Tara. Good. How you doing?
Good. So we are here for POP, Prevention on Point, where we discuss prevention topics on and around substance use here in our Twin Counties.
And for our first show today, we are tackling the subject of stigma. Let's just start with the Webster's definition.
All right, definition. Here we go. Yeah.
A set of negative and unfair beliefs that a society or a group of people have about something. That's one. A mark of shame or discredit, a stain. And the third one, it's an archaic definition, a scar left by a hot iron.
Mm.
Yeah, I thought scar was very evocative.
Well, I mean, I think that's a word that people who have felt stigma would agree. It might not be a visual scar to the human body, but when we do talk about different kinds of stigma through mental illness with stigma or substance use disorder and stigma, people can hurt their bodies. But most of these scars, unfortunately, we are finding mentally. They're self-stigma, they're societal stigma. There's stigma in so many different areas of people's lives. But I think, you know, something that we really want to focus on today is, you know, the stigma around substance use disorder, misuse and use, and how often this affects people's recovery and journey through this disease.
Maybe we should try to start from the beginning and talk about words.
Yeah.
And, you know, you already used a term that, before I was in this world of dealing with people that have been impacted by addiction, I didn't necessarily use the word that you just used, substance use disorder. So why do words matter? Like, why are we, you know, it's a fair question. Are we nitpicking? Are we expecting too much of people by asking them to change their whole vocabulary?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question, because we are living in a time where people are becoming more knowledgeable on how words can affect others. And many see it as a softening of our society instead of an acceptance of our society. I happen to feel that it's an acceptance of others. People who have been called certain names, if we want to go into, you know, substance use disorder, you know, we hear words such as junkie or addict, alcoholic. None of these, and by golly, they sound so rough when you say them too, right? They have like this really hard consonant sound, so they don't even sound nice coming off the human tongue.
Using the word junkie now to me feels way different than it did like, you know, 15 years ago.
Education and information, right?
That's right, education. And, you know, it's really interesting. It gets dull, and, you know, when people talk about using different words, it can feel really didactic and preachy and all that. But
100%. And I think that's the difficulty here, is that I am not going to change. You are not going to change people's personal feelings on this. But what we hope is that we can grow sensitivity and empathy for people with substance use disorder, with substance misuse. I think that's part of the stigma too, that our society doesn't assist in helping get rid of this stigma, is that a lot of times in our social media, in our television shows, in our movies, people who are using substances are often seen as the person that doesn't have a home, that a person that is living on the streets. This is not 100%. There are teachers in our local schools. There are politicians and lawyers and doctors, social workers. Every field, everywhere in this country, there is someone with substance use disorder.
That's right.
It does not discriminate on your educational level at all. These words mean nothing positive. And I think this is where, you know, substance use disorder, instead of saying that person is an addict, is so important, especially because this is a medical condition. This is diagnosable. This is treatable. And I think that's the part that we have to change, that stigma, because a lot of people see it as a mental weakness. They aren't strong enough to overcome. And when people really do look into the research and to how the brain is functioning around substance use disorder and or misuse, your brain changes completely.
Substance use disorder being a, what would you call it? What would you say? Something you were born with? Some kind of chemical imbalance? What? How do you?
There's so many factors that come into substance use disorder. Of course, you know, we're all as humans predisposed to so many different conditions. You know, genetically, there are things awaiting in our DNA to come alive. There's diseases, there's intelligence, right? So substance use disorder is one of those diseases that can have a genetic predisposition, of course. Then when we look into a person's life, is there trauma? I mean, there is evidence that shows that people with more trauma tend to be more subject to substance use disorder as well. And then we also know, in New York State, that the average age of first consumption of a substance, no matter what that is, whether it's nicotine, whether it's cannabis, whether it's alcohol, is the age of 12, which is quite young when we think about the human brain and the brain development. The human brain doesn't fully mature until the age of 25. So at the age of 12, we are literally introducing high levels of dopamine with these substances that are literally rewiring the brain. And there is evidence to show this. There are PET scans that show how the brain functions differently because it's been hijacked.
You know, Tara, you and I, we used to present about the impact of tobacco marketing and you know, the science of addiction to seventh graders. And I feel like we both had a lot of success talking to 12 and 13 year olds. They actually pay attention when you talk about their brain being hijacked.
Well, yeah, especially when we're talking to our young adults. I mean, they're forced to make decisions, you know, usually by the time of 18, of what are you going to be when you're an adult? Their brain hasn't even fully developed yet. So how do they know what they're going to be? And I think when you give them that, it's almost like a gift. Like, your brain isn't fully developed yet. You have so much that you can learn and become. You almost see their eyes light up.
I got so much pleasure, and I still do, when I talk about it and they don't know that yet. And yeah, you can see the almost the relief or something.
And I think if, you know, people can look at that and know that, stigma could start to change. As we know, there's stigma around mental illness. There's stigma in substance use. There's stigma for the color of our skin. There's stigma for our religions, right? And it really just comes down to information and education around these things. So when we had spoken to you previously about how stigma has affected me, and it's embarrassing to say that when I interviewed for my job, and I pulled in to the parking lot at Twin County Recovery Services, the first thought in my head was, who is going to see my car in this parking lot? As I was walking
in. The very first thought.
Very first
When you're applying
thought.
For a job to be
yeah.
in this field.
And that was a real eye opener for stigma for me, because that I had to look myself in the mirror.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, wait.
If I want this job and right. this is something I truly believe in, I better look in the mirror. I don't want to be a person that is delivering a message that I don't believe in. You know, for somebody that works in this field and has worked in this field to feel that way upon a job interview, I think just shows that we all have a little bit of stigma around certain things.
Yeah.
And even within the community of people who have a diagnosis of substance use disorder, there's a stigma. Well, I just use alcohol. Oh, well, I don't use heroin. That really doesn't matter. A substance is a substance is a substance. People are affected by substance use disorder no matter what their substance of choice is. So I think we just really have to be kind and educated and really just be there for people. To me, it's no different than somebody having diabetes. Like, there is treatment for diabetes and there's treatment for substance use disorder. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes people with diabetes want to go have a piece of cake.
That's right.
Is that the best decision they've ever made? Probably not. And just like people with substance use disorder, sometimes they go out and maybe their drug of choice is alcohol and they go have a drink. Was that a great choice? Not a great choice. And I think when it comes to, you know, as you know, with your role as a family navigator, this doesn't just end with the person that has been diagnosed with substance use disorder. It is a family disease, absolutely, and not just genetically, right?
Right.
This is a disease that people often have a hard time talking about to their friends or their pastor or other family members that this is occurring within the walls of their home.
You touched on so many things. We talked about the conditions that lead someone to have problems with substance use. And I, you know, only recent, again, not until I started working in this field was I aware of something called the biopsychosocial model. Biology, the psychology, the social environment, and how all those things interact. I mean, what percentage of people who struggle with substance use disorder that have some kind of trauma or abuse or something in their background or maybe family situation that's normalized that behavior?
Absolutely. And I think that's, you know, where the education comes from. And that's sometimes where we make judgments, because for some families, using substances is their normal. Maybe using substances to the point where somebody is misusing them or could be diagnosed with a substance use disorder is normal. And so looking for treatment isn't always a necessity for those families. Unfortunately, we do see that continued cycle of trauma. One of the things called ACE score, you know, the adverse childhood experiences.
That's an acronym, ACE, in case you're not aware of it.
Yeah. And that is one of the models that are often used in what you just spoke about, that biopsychosocial model. You know, there is the biology of the person, right? There's the psychology of the person, and there's the life they've lived. And that is what the ACE score comes down to. And most people with substance use disorder do have a high ACE score.
So there are all three of those areas are risk. There's risk there, right?
Absolutely.
Where can we take this from here?
I would like to allow people to just hear this and maybe hopefully reflect on people in their lives, people they know, whether it's family or friends. And we're not saying, you know, bail people out. We're not saying things like that. But I think just understanding this disease helps to reduce the stigma, because maybe then when you hear somebody say, oh, well, they're just a junkie, it might hit you a little bit differently. You might have that empathy for another human being that's struggling with a disease. Just as in when we hear about people who are struggling with other diseases, we have benefits and we do things for people to support them. And there are so many ways to support somebody with substance use disorder.
Going back to the thing about, you know, words are powerful.
Yeah.
Words contain all of these epic histories of oppression, and they reinforce ideas that favor one person over another. And it is so powerful.
I think for me, it would be interesting to hear from anybody listening about how stigma has affected their life, whether it's they themselves, somebody with substance use or misuse disorder, or if it's somebody in their family. I just know from us going out to public events, whether we're in high schools or senior centers or county fairs or wherever it happens to be, we always get a beautiful story.
So much of the healing happens in those spaces, AA meetings or whatever kind of thing, is from people sharing their stories.
100%. Yeah. And I think I don't think people realize that this stigma is a barrier for people to getting treatment. No, I hate to bring it back to myself, but I was going in for a job interview that was going to pay me, right? And I felt stigma of having my car in the parking lot. Can you imagine having that same feeling, probably, and then walking in the door for treatment?
Oh my goodness. And there you
and
go.
And having to disclose substances you've used, decisions you've made.
Right.
You have to have a urine screen. That's not always the most comfortable situation. There are so many things that can affect people and create those barriers for people to walk in the door to get treatment. And one of them is this stigma and the attitudes and beliefs around people who are diagnosed with substance use disorder.
I appreciate you speaking from that standpoint of the person and remembering how hard it is. In my own, I can say this, in my own life of having friends and family members with substance use disorder, it still took me years. You know, I had to do internet searches on my own privately. And then it took me years of that before I would even reach out to another human being and talk about it.
Again, that's education and information. I know a few years ago, a local coalition that everybody should take the opportunity to look at if they can, because it gives a lot of information about substance use disorder programs and supports within our two counties is the Columbia Green Addiction Coalition.
Yep.
And they are able on their website to have tons of supports available, you know, just at the click of your mouse.
Be a sort of a clearinghouse for at least for the local supports,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. Absolutely. And even things such as I know about 5 years ago through that organization, we had a prevention committee. And one of the things that we wound up working on was talking to our local media sources about how even a picture of somebody's substance with maybe a spoon and a syringe and things that people would use is stigmatizing. And that even those little things like that can really affect people with substance use disorder and then continue this negative stigma. You know, it goes as far as, you know, in people's obituaries, it isn't always disclosed. I'm not saying people should say that they, you know, passed from an overdose, but sometimes that almost that, you know, had a battle with substance use disorder is the truth.
Thank you for bringing that up. As I understand, one of the ways that our country was able to break through some of the stigma and address the opioid epidemic was because there were so many deaths due to overdose that weren't mentioned in the obituaries. The folks in the hospital were seeing it in terrible
and
detail.
And our first responders.
And the first responders. Yeah. And it wasn't being put on the record.
Yeah.
The outrage from that is partly what the push for policy change, right?
Well, you know, and that's because that's where that stigma comes in, right? Like, oh, these people made poor choices. It's immoral. There's so many words I could come up with that just fed into that stigma. And if we, you know, really go back, and I think people are educated, and there has been movies and there has been media coverage on the opioid epidemic that is starting to really make changes. I think that's why we're seeing this decrease in overdose deaths across the country, because things such as naloxone, which some people may know as Narcan, is saving lives.
Narcan and education about stigma and even in harm reduction, we've been doing it long enough now, and it's been out there long enough that the numbers, the data is starting to show an improvement, right?
It is. And that isn't because there are less substances in our country or our communities. I think it's because people are now making a choice. And once you overdose and have that ability to have Narcan, it does make a difference in people's lives. And not just because they're alive, but
I mean, waking up in an ambulance
Yeah.
For a lot of people, that's a turn of the page. That's a major chapter change.
And this is given, I think, the opportunity for people to get that treatment, get the diagnosis, get the help they need. It's opening up the door for programs that have always been here, but now again, I think are becoming more acceptable.
You know, another thing really moving related to stigma is the times that I have gone into senior centers in the area and given presentations or community conversations about some aspect of addiction. It is so refreshing often how open they are about it. And to see how older people speak about it is beautiful and fascinating.
Yeah, we should bring them with us, I think, sometimes.
Really, they are the best advocates.
You know, of course, the longer that we're on this planet, the more we see, right? And the more experiences we have and the more people we've met. And when we go to these meetings, people are very honest. I think that's one of our largest populations that we have given Narcan training to, which I love. I love because, at least for me, anybody that is older than me and has something to say, I'm going to listen.
You know, and shout out to MHACG Youth Clubhouses. These are programs that have been training teenagers to train others in Narcan.
Yeah.
For years now. And what's more beautiful, the sight of seeing a 17-year-old training a senior.
Yeah.
And how to use Narcan.
Yeah. And they want to learn.
This isn't like checking a box.
Correct.
Or anything. This is like real stuff.
It's just like, you know, it's first aid and CPR at this point. I think it should just be a part of that training model, because the reality is you may run up on somebody who you think needs first aid and CPR, which they probably do, but the first thing they may need is Narcan.
I feel like it's probably good right here to mention that, again, there's a whole universe of stigma around Narcan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people, when we table and we have Narcan available for free, people come up to me, and I'm sure they do to you, and they're like, am I going to get caught? If the police find this in my car, like, am I going to get in trouble?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard so many different things. I've heard that, definitely. I've heard, oh, I don't need that. That doesn't happen in my family.
All the time. I hear that so much.
And I, you know, the reality is, again, that's, for me, it's attaching it to first aid and CPR. This is a life-saving technique. That's it. You're not going to hurt somebody.
I think about, I do a lot of outreach in libraries because I, you know, they're neutral places and you see all types of people in libraries, and a lot of dear friends and relatives that are librarians too. And they are often what they call involuntary first responders. And thinking about like how important it is for librarians to know how to use Narcan.
Absolutely.
Right?
And then again, I think that's just another stigma breaker, because with getting a training for Narcan, you are learning more about substance use disorder. You're learning more about this disease. Maybe you'll even talk about it. I mean, I remember this summer while we were at the Greene County Youth Fair.
Yep.
There was a dog exposition that was also going on, and they came over and got Narcan because they had to actually treat their dogs with Narcan because they had taken a pill. The dogs had eaten a pill that was on the hotel floor. They didn't know about it. And the dogs were overdosing from a human medication, and they gave the dogs Narcan.
I was like, wow, I had never even thought, you know.
No. But then let's think about it, right? Dogs eat everything that's in front of them.
Right. And if there's one thing that crosses all political boundaries, it's people's pets.
Yeah. So, you know, this education around Narcan can help to deplete our current stigmas that are happening. This stigma often is just very attacking of somebody's character. And it isn't always looking at the person as a whole. Just as any other disease, such as diabetes or cancer or something of that nature, a diagnosable disease, it doesn't just affect their mind, it affects their body, it affects them financially, it affects their careers. We really have to look at this holistic approach on how to treat people. Are they a parent? Where do they live? Maybe that's not a place that is beneficial for them with a substance use disorder. Just certain things that we can do to break those walls and those boundaries that in their treatment of substance use disorder.
It's all about those individual conditions. Could we talk for a second about some of the, I want to talk about some of the manifestations of stigma that I see.
Okay.
That psychologists talk about. What happens when stigma exists? You know, when stigma is just out there flowing freely. Some of the manifestations of stigma that you see mentioned most often are feelings of isolation, guilt, shame, self-blame, secrets.
Yeah, I think that becomes a coping mechanism. The stigma can affect you in so many different ways. Not one modality of treatment is going to always assist somebody through this.
One of the approaches that I co-facilitate in mutual aid groups for families and loved ones of someone who uses substances is called the invitation to change approach, and I'll get into it in another episode probably. But
yeah.
one of the absolute cornerstones of that approach, and in the science, we talk about how one size doesn't fit all. Treatment looks different for, and recovery looks different for everybody. And the more options that you can give somebody, the more success they'll have. Yeah, I certainly went into it early on thinking, oh, well, my loved one, they just have to go to inpatient treatment for at least 28 days. Obviously, you know, that's just what people do.
The average is 7 times, right?
Is that what it is? Yeah. 7 times?
Yeah. So yeah. I think that's the hard thing. You know, a lot of times it's a process that everybody has individually. I can't tell that person how they feel, and nor can you. But as a person that has a diagnosis of substance use disorder, can you imagine walking to see a new provider? What if you're walking in to see a new dentist? What if you're, you know, these are the things that we forget that can affect people with substance use disorder. These are things that people with substance use disorder need to disclose. What if they're on medical assisted treatment? They need to disclose this to medical providers as well. And sometimes that might be anticipated stigma, that might not be real.
Yeah, imagined or, like you said, anticipated.
But it does, that's another boundary and another barrier for people to move forward. And then I think there's always something that we hear about with substance use disorder, which we don't hear about in a lot of other diseases and illnesses, is blame.
Yeah, let's talk about blame.
This is my personal opinion. There may be research on it. I haven't looked. But I believe a lot of times that people are ready to blame others. There's maybe not necessarily the person with substance use disorder, but others around them are ready to be like, oh, well, that's because so-and-so did this to them. Or this is because, I just feel like people are ready to not understand substance use disorder, but they're always looking for somebody to blame substance use disorder on.
If you're in crisis or need support, you can call the National Suicide and Crisis Hotline at 988. And we welcome your feedback.
Yeah, these are really important topics that might trigger people. So that 988 hotline is really important, and we'll be giving that out in each show. But if you'd like to talk to us directly, you can email us at TaraE, that's TARAE, at TwinCountyRecoveryServices.org, or and Brian at Brian Z, BRYANZ, at TwinCountyRecoveryServices.org.
And in our next episode, which will air on Friday, April 18th, we'll be discussing alcohol as part of Alcohol Awareness Month.
Yeah, April is Alcohol Awareness Month, so we want to really try to highlight these things as we go through the year and discuss topics, again, that are important to prevention here in our Twin Counties.
Thank you all for listening. We hope to catch you again.
See ya.
Bye-bye.